like deja vu being up here again so soon. I think Mr. Ellis forgot to glance at the bottom of his previous schedule possibly, but who knows. Well, last year I was talking to my dad and sort of on the spur of the moment, we decided to go to the Stockman's Hall of Fame at Longreach. And four of us ended up going, my brother and my boy Mitchell and my dad and I. And it was really a good trip. And I'd never really been out that far before, I don't think. And the Stockman's Hall of Fame was very well presented and really interesting. Well, Dad had read quite a bit about the old bushmen of years gone by when he was young, and he was very excited to see a lot of the exhibits and displays of people he recognised. And yet most of them were names I had never heard of. Well, one particular area of the exhibit out there is highlighting famous men and women of the outback who have achieved something and helped Australia in its expansion. And Dad came across one sign, he said, "Oh, here's the cattle king." And he pointed to this picture of this man and a bit of a description of him. And I'd never heard of a cattle king. And there it was, Sir Sidney Kidman. He was knighted in the 1930s for services to Australia. And when we got home, Dad dug around and found an old book and he said, here's the story of the cattle king. It was a book he'd gotten when he was a boy. He thought I might be interested. And what I read in that book was quite incredible, because this man accomplished an amazing amount in his life. He became the biggest cattle rancher in the world. He developed huge areas of isolated Australia. He had a huge number of stations in Queensland, in Northern Territory, South Australia, New South Wales. And from nothing, when he ran away at the home at the age of 13, he became the greatest landholder in the British Empire. And probably, they say, probably the greatest landholder in modern history. Because at his death in 1935, he had a controlling interest in over 300,000 square kilometres of land, which was more than the state of Victoria, which is about 250,000 square kilometres. So he owned or had a controlling interest in more land than the size of the state of Victoria. But the most amazing thing about this man's life is that hardly anyone remembers who he is. And all that accomplishment forgotten within 50 years. And when I thought about this man, I thought of the words of Solomon. Because he says, "For a wise man, like a fool, will not be long remembered. In his days both come and die, and both will be forgotten. Like the fool, the wise man also dies." Everyone in this life strives to achieve something. And he was a man who achieved it all, and yet it was all so temporary, forgotten so soon after his death by the bulk of Australia. And I often thought too, and in the same vein, I saw the movie The Last Emperor a few years ago. And it was the story of the last Manchu emperor of China. And this was a boy who was born as the god king to rule. And he lived in all the splendour of the Forbidden Palace there in Beijing. And eventually, watch the story, he was arrested and he ended up being imprisoned for many years and he was released as a middle-aged person. And what struck me most, though, was towards the end of the movie where this man was just dressed in peasant outfit. He was just blurred into the billion of the other Chinese. And he rode his cheap old bike one day down to the palace. And he parked it there and he took his few coins in. And he paid his entrance fee just like any other visitor to the Forbidden Palace. And he walked in and he stood in front of the throne there and looked where the Emperor of China once ruled. And that was him. And now he was a peasant, totally unknown. And really, life's full of such stories of old movie stars and prime ministers and presidents who grow old and are totally forgotten. And really, one of the big lessons of life is that it is so incredibly temporary. And that all these things we can spend so much time and worry and money on and everything else, oftentimes can be fairly meaningless in the long run. So I'd like to talk today of the importance of spending your time on things that are creating something permanent for the future. Everyone dreams as a teenager of accomplishing something with their life. Maybe to be a great sportsman or a great musician or a famous scientist or maybe just being plain rich. Everyone would like to achieve certain things in their life. And people are having these midlife crises now because they realise suddenly around the age of 40 maybe that maybe their life's slipping away and they haven't done what they thought they wanted to do in their life. And there are those who do achieve things and they always want something more. You see people, well-known people like Madonna or Michael Jackson or, not to put them in the same class, Prince Charles. who have achieved status and fame and money, whatever you call it, yet there seems to be something lacking. You seem they're just searching or trying to find something else. They're not really content. Just turn over to Ecclesiastes 3. There's a good section of scripture here to describe what's sort of going on here. Ecclesiastes 3 in verse 10. "And I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. And God has made everything beautiful in its time, and he has also put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from the beginning to the end." God has put eternity into the hearts of men and women. And except you can spend your whole life striving to find the answers of life out, just trying to solve this feeling of temporariness and get permanence. But it says here, no one really can work it out, what God's doing. We've got an idea, we see it through a glass darkly, as Paul described it. "I know there is nothing better for them to rejoice and to do good in their lives." Solomon's saying, we can strive and trying to solve the mysteries of life and put our whole effort into trying to achieve these things, but really there's nothing better than to do good in our lives. "And also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy all the good of his labour, and is the gift of God." God has given us this life as a gift to enjoy the good of it, to feel happy and content in the way we are now, and we don't have to have this feeling of lack of content because it's temporary. And what he's saying is, basically, there's nothing better than to do good and to enjoy the gifts that God has given us. We really don't need to seek fame and fortune to have a full and satisfying life, because we never really, those things won't give us that satisfaction. Doing good and enjoying what we have will, though, when done in the proper perspective, a few other things I want to talk about today will give us that sense of satisfaction that people look for. I'd like to mention a few points. They're simple, but it's important when we think about how short our life really is here. The first point is, it's a very simple point, remember that our life is temporary. And think about that. Oftentimes we don't think about it. We think about the fact here that we're only here for a relatively short period of time. And if you're young and you don't believe that, just go and ask your parents. And what you usually find out is they'll tell you how fast time has gone, that it seems just like the other day that they were teenagers. And take the time to look at your grandparents, because that is you in a few years' time. That is you. That's what your life is about. And if we turn over to 1 Peter, verse 24, you'll see the way that it was described. It's a quotation from the Old Testament. 1 Peter 1:24, the way Peter described life. It actually follows on from the scripture that we've been hearing quite a bit about, being born again, not of corruptible seed, but of incorruptible. In verse 24 he says, "All flesh is as grass, and all the glory of men as the flower of the grass. And the grass withers and the flower falls away, but the word of the Lord endures forever." All the glory that men have, whether it be the glory of Solomon or Sidney Kidman and all he accomplished, all withers away, basically usually at your death. And just face the facts, and it's good to think of sometimes when you're young, to think of, one day I'll be old. What am I going to do in the intermediate time? It's oftentimes closer than we think, because I speak to old people and I find that the time has gone very, very fast for them. The second point is, you really don't have to repeat the same mistakes that everyone else seems to repeat. Seems to be, despite the fact that life is so temporary, people repeat the same mistakes over and over again. And there's a well-known saying that it says, a person who doesn't know the lessons of history is bound to repeat them. And over again, the world repeats the same mistakes. And often these same mistakes start when people are teenagers. They don't look at the lesson of the older generation. And the classic mistake, you see it over and over again, it's just incredible, is for someone to be involved with sex before they're married. Now, it's just so totally short-sighted, because the silly thing is that without any doubt in the world, those same people will be sorry one day they did it, without any doubt at all. It may be in the short term, it may be in the long term when they're sitting down talking to their own kids, but they will be sorry. So why do something that has been proven over and over again and stated clearly to cause problems in life? So don't waste your valuable years. Don't try and repeat the same things that others repeat, thinking somehow that they've accomplished something in life. Use your youth to grow in things that are permanent. and ask your elders for advice on making your life a truly permanent, successful life. Learn from the mistakes of others. And the third point is to strive to put your time into things that uplift and to build. A short amount of time we have here, put that time into things that uplift and that build. You spend so much time worrying about things or harbouring grudges or being jealous or whatever it is. But when you see how fast kids grow up and how time flies, it's so foolish to have some of these things become long-term problems. One example, as it seems to happen again, is the classic family squabbles that go on for years. I'm talking about ones that last so long, that parents not talking to children or parents-in-law not getting along with their son or daughter-in-laws. And some people let these things go on so long that their own health is affected and that they're creating divisions that can never be healed, possibly, without a lot of effort. It could all be solved with a simple change of attitude of applying God's principles and thinking about the best of others. Life's really too short for these sort of things to last and to go on and on. Because before you know it, you'll miss the most valuable years of your life to uplift and to build others. And you'll possibly one day be old and lonely and be very sorry that you didn't solve that problem many years previously. And the scripture comes to mind in Philippians, whatsoever is good and lovely, think on these things. Don't fill your mind with other things, somehow thinking you're solving these problems when in actual fact you're creating them. My grandfather is dying at the moment. He's 91 years of age. We're all hoping he'll pick up, but he seems to be resigned to leaving this world as fast as he can. As I said to him just the other day, he said, well, you really can't complain. You've had a good life. But as I was talking to him, I was sitting there speaking to him with the family last week, and I was suddenly struck with this feeling of deja vu, because I remembered 1974. I was a teenager and I came down from Mackay at the time, and I was called in because my great-grandmother was dying, and my grandfather was standing next to me at the time watching one of the old generations, and she was 91 at the same time, 90 I think she was. And the intervening years have gone so incredibly fast, and now there's another generation, my grandparents this time, who have come up, and it's their turn. It seems amazing that time has gone so fast. But what was so funny is he asked me about, he said, do you think there's a heaven? Do you think there's a hell? He said, I can't believe there's a hell. And I thought it was strange that an old man would ask his grandson some of these questions about the meaning of life. Because he had nearly 100 years to find some of those things out or even look into them. Now let's hope he lives for many more years to come, but he's certainly failing fast at the moment. But I thought there's a lesson there. I don't want to be in my old age lying there asking someone about the meaning of life. And yet if you don't persist in putting things in perspective, you can lose your understanding. And I could just as easily end up like my grandfather saying on my deathbed, what's life really all about? So take the time to think on and dwell on the temporariness of life and think about what its purpose is and put it in a true perspective. I'd like to conclude today with the words of a wise man. He's not a Bible character, but it's the words of James Baker, the former United States Secretary of State. And this man was a White House Chief of Staff under Ronald Reagan, and he was the second most powerful man in the United States under George Bush. And I was driving home, I came across this script. I was driving home in the car last year, and I heard a radio talkback show, and I sent away for the transcript because I was so impressed what he had to say. Because this man had been at the centre of power for a decade. And listen to what this man had to say. James Baker had to say about the meeting at a meeting a few years ago in Washington. He says, I found out early on that having a position of power really doesn't bring the fulfillment that many people think it does. Of course, it does bring excitement. It does bring a sense of satisfaction when things go well, disappointment when they don't, and it brings invitations to some of the most exclusive gatherings in the world. But it also brings a complicated lifestyle with an exhausting schedule, innumerable headaches, and lots of conflicts. And more importantly, having a position of power does not bring inner security or fulfillment. Now, this man was the pinnacle of what you accomplish in life pretty well. He says it does not bring inner security or fulfillment. He says that comes only by developing a personal relationship with God. I thought of quite amazing words. I somehow can't imagine them coming out of the mouth of Paul Keating for some reason. But he continues. He says, in 1986, I met with a group of diplomats gathered here for this national prayer breakfast. And one of them asked me during the course of that meeting, what was the most important thing I'd learned since being in Washington? This is a man who had gone and toured the world and seen through the things of Gorbachev and Israel and everything else. He said, what was the most important thing I'd learned since being in Washington? And I replied that it was the fact that temporary power is fleeting. And I told him about an experience that I had had early one morning a few years ago when I was the White House Chief of Staff. And as my driver turned into the car into the Northwest Gate, I looked down Pennsylvania Avenue and I noticed a man walking alone, a Chief of Staff of a prior administration. And yet there he was alone, no reporters, no security, no adoring public, no trappings of power. And he goes on to say, and that mental picture continually serves to remind me of the impermanence of power and the impermanence of place. That man had it all, but he had it all only for a time. Now, it's incredibly rare to hear words of wisdom from a leader like that. This man has the true perspective on life, that there's really no permanence of position or goods in this life. All of it will fade away faster than you really think. Therefore, use the time to build up for the future, to lay the groundwork when you are young for true permanence. This life is only temporary, but it holds the seeds of which eternity springs.
Good morning, everyone. I wish you all a very happy Sabbath. I hope it's been that way for you thus far. Now, we have some good news. Noel and Bernie Free would like to announce the engagement of their eldest daughter, Judith, to Paul, eldest son of Leonie Stockman. A late 94 wedding is planned. So isn't that good news? All very nice. But that's not the only one. Mr. and Mrs. Edward Cheeseman have pleasure in announcing the marriage of their youngest daughter to Dwayne Lithgow of Chermside on Sunday the 5th of December, 93, Inaugura Army Chapel, and the groom is an officer in the Army Intelligence Corps. So congratulations then to the Stockman family and the Cheeseman family and the others involved in those two marriages. That's good news. Very happy for all of those people concerned. Not only that, but Brad and Julie Pitcher had a baby this morning. They announced the arrival of a baby girl, a sister for Ryan. The baby was born at 4:30 this morning. I bet many of you weren't up at 4:30 this morning. But anyway, the Pitchers were, so they have a baby and all is well. That's good news for them. Now, we've got a number of children that bring toys to the church services here. And I guess we've sort of go along with that to a degree. Parents are trying to find the balance between, well, what can you bring? What isn't distracting? What amuses the children? What doesn't distract your neighbour? There's a bit of a fine balance in some of those things. But I'll just comment here about this from one or two directions. First of all, one family have lost a Game Boy game. These little computer game things, it's gone. Now, the implication is that somebody else has taken it from the church. That may or may not be the case, of course. Sometimes there are twists and turns for these things. But if someone does have it, they've borrowed it for a week, or whatever we might say, we'd like to see it back. So that's of concern in itself. The other thing is, just by way of a general comment with regard to that type of thing at church. Ideally, you wind up with your children listening to the messages and even, miracle of miracles, taking notes. It is possible, but I know there's a transition from dot to adulthood, and there are various stages, and each child will be different going through the stages. But I would like to see in descending order a young adult, a teenager, a child in that sense, listening to what is being said, possibly taking notes. And if below that is all totally, utterly boring, then perhaps they should read something which is significant. And I don't mean phantom. I mean something worthwhile. That would be my next descending order of priorities. Well, at least read something profitable. You could even get Bible stories in comic form. I mean, that would be better than some of the other things that come along. And then you descend below that to the point where there's a baby on the floor and it has soft, cuddly toys, but not noisy rattles, obviously. But in that young childhood age, the idea of bringing these computer things to church, I'm not sure that's a good idea. Now, you'll have to, as a parent, decide what you think's good for your family. But I don't think that here is the time and place to use those games. All right? Now, I think you just need to think this one through yourself as a family as to what your progression is in that way. I'm not exactly a computer fan, so I have a bias. In fact, I would burn the lot tomorrow, but I'm only slightly to the right of Attila the Hun. Who, by the way, was a very interesting character, but I shouldn't talk about that. I read a book he wrote. It was very, very interesting. He's a very wise man, as well as being from a stock that was rather hardy. I would feel with the computer situation that my sense of it is that they're like a drug. You get your eyes fixed on that screen and you'll find your child, this is my experience, it may not be your experience, your child could probably sit there from dawn till dusk, never eating, never sleeping, never stirring until he's beaten the game, whatever it is he's got to beat. And if he fails, he'll probably smash the machine to pieces at the end of the day. Now, I don't know, you may have cool, calm and collected people in your family, but it seems to me that there's a sense of commitment to some of those toy games that are probably not really appropriate all the time. Now, if at church it's the only time in the whole child's life you can ever play the game, well, then you've got to work that out in your family. But I suspect it's a convenient babysitting device for us, and I speak collectively, I'm not singling out anyone. And I would suspect that if we thought about it very carefully, it may not be the best thing to bring to church. Well, that's my instant thoughts on that one. You might muse on that with your own family and what you think would be most desirable. I personally think books are the answer. And I think the skill of reading and the comprehension that comes from it is the greatest skill you will ever, ever acquire in life. Now, you want to think that one through very carefully as well. But that's my thoughts on that. In the meantime, I'm very sorry one has gone missing and we would like it back. But I'd like to see them left at home as well. In fact, I'd like to see them banned. But you know what would happen if we banned them? They'd be available under the counter, wouldn't they? Isn't that what man does? And the price would go up accordingly. All right, coming back to other things of greater note, perhaps. Would all those who signed up to play basketball on the 12th December weekend please meet with Paul Bellamy at the notice board immediately after services today, where he has the schedule of all the games and the times and everything else to do with that. So that would be appreciated if you'd do that. Now, that weekend, the basketball weekend, was also going to be our YOU Bible study evening. So with the clash of that, and being the generous people we are, we've decided to postpone the YOU study for 1 week. So if you can bear with us, the YOU study is now the 18th, Saturday, 1 week later, still at the Brownings. Still be the scintillating evening you expect, but it will be a week later because of the basketball, so we can accommodate all things. If you are wanting to transfer to Harvey Bay, Caloundra, Gold Coast or Marimbula, then you do need to get that for, well, not Gold Coast, I mean you can automatically go to the Gold Coast from here, but if you want to transfer to Marimbula, Caloundra, Harvey Bay, you do need to get that form in today. They'll be sent back to the office this week. And the reason for that is, of course, accommodations and so on. Well, before the sermon, we do have the privilege of hearing some special music. We have a violin solo by Jemima Robertson. It's entitled Allegro Brillante, and it's by William Harvey. And we look forward to hearing Jemima play. And after that, we will have the sermon for today. Jemima. Delightful. Very pleasant music. I guess that wakes everyone up. I must apologize to you because last week in the closing parts of my sermon I forgot to turn to the scripture I said I would. So I will. It was actually Matthew 25. It wasn't until afterwards it was pointed out and I thought about it that I'd forgotten to get back to it. So I'll sort of begin by where I left off. If you weren't here last week, I'm sorry about that. Matthew 25, and I was going to read the section, verse 34 to 40. If you can remember this far back, I was talking about oppression and the difficulties that we face in life with oppression in various ways. And verse 34 begins where the king says to those on the right hand, come and inherit, and so on. Verse 35, when I was hungry, you gave me something to eat, and thirsty, you gave me a drink, and I was a stranger, and you took me in. Whenever I was short of clothes, you helped to clothe me, and when I was sick, you looked after me, and when I was in prison, you came to see me. And the righteous answered in verse 37 and said, well, Lord, well, we didn't see you in this state. When did this happen? In verse 40, the king replied, I tell you the truth, that whenever, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me. And that was the point I was closing on last time, that principle, that issue, that it is important in that Good Samaritan sense that we talked about, those things are seen to be done, and that is a part of our Christian life. So that was the scripture I'd meant to turn to. And it was very much apropos, I thought, the subject and the occasion. Now, speaking of oppression, I'd like to talk to you about children today. And families and parenting. Now, our children are not necessarily oppressive. Perhaps it's the parents who are oppressive. But either way, it has its ups and downs. Some of the greatest stresses today come from the family unit. Of that there is no doubt. Many issues, many perceptions, different things that people see. Even the best of families have hassles and flaws and stresses. And some people have, in the church, spiritual flaws in the sense that they think things will work out in a certain way because they are in the church or because they are religious or whatever it may be. I'll give you some typical case histories of where people feel that things will work out, but in fact it isn't necessarily like that. One is this, that people might say something like, all my problems will be solved if and when I become a Christian. Just by joining the church, suddenly all my problems are solved. And of course the answer is, that's not true. That is not the case. It doesn't work that way. Or another person might say, well, all my problems will be solved because the answers are in the Bible. Well, in principle they may be, but in reality it's finding them and then acting on them. So it may not be because they're in the Bible that you'll find the answers to your problems. Another flaw that people have in their thinking very often is this sort of thing. They'll say, well, if anyone has a problem, it must be that they're sinning. They must be sinning if they have a problem. Well, that's not necessarily true either. Problems can be common to all, whether we're good or bad or indifferent. So these things will come and go. Other people sometimes will say, the Bible has a teaching which, if you follow, will automatically solve all your problems. Well, that's a catch-all phrase. You could technically argue it might be true, but it doesn't work that way. It isn't that simple. Life doesn't go in that direction. And so, when we think about children, parenting, families, things of that sort, it is good to turn to God for clarification. It is good to turn to God for help with solutions to problems. But I would suggest to you that it's wrong to expect God to solve every problem instantaneously just because we've asked. It doesn't work that way. If you've been around long enough, you'll know it doesn't work that way. To the extent that today people can be very confused about family roles, I mean, reflecting society this is, but it also comes through into the church. People can be very confused about family roles and what is required. There's a very famous quote about education and parenting. It goes like this. The education of a child begins 100 years before he or she is born. Now, it's a good quote. And, of course, the implication is that the education of the child is hinged upon the parents and the grandparents beforehand. What your parents and grandparents have set in motion is what you're going to reap. And that, of course, is a difficult one. Very, very difficult. But it's essentially a true statement. So the education of us all begins 100 years before we're born. We're products. Now, you come to our society today, and you look at parenting, and this culture that we live in, and I'll give you some quotes, and I'll show you how confused people are. There's a quote in the papers in the past few weeks, and these are all recent newspaper quotes I'm referring to. The Mothers' Union, a fine body of people, said this: today, we are overinflating the importance of the nuclear family. And what the preamble was going on to say was, it doesn't have to be two parents, 1.3 children or 2.3 children or whatever it is. That whole nuclear family concept is overrated. They saw it in terms of it doesn't matter what the configuration would be. Now, you can see where they might be coming from, but they're knocking what is an established form of a family structure. And I'm suggesting there's an amount of confusion there. Translate it this way. You know that today, lesbian couples can adopt children. Now, you may or may not approve of that, depending on your own background and feelings and so on. But it's happening a little more frequently in many, many Western countries, perhaps more than we realize. The theory in society is it doesn't really matter. The child can just have as good a time and as healthy a life as anybody else. Now, these are all examples, remember, to show you that I think with parenting, there is confusion out there. There isn't a consensus as to what one should do. The Duchess of York recently is quoted in the papers as saying she doesn't mind if her husband takes the children on a holiday with another woman. I'm just saying to you that I think what you've got in society is a spread of ideas where people are quite confused about parenting. If you understood about the 100-year mark beforehand, you wouldn't so flippantly say, it doesn't matter who you go on holiday with or who you sleep with or what happens here or there. Anything. You wouldn't say that if you saw the end result of all of those things that happen. But these people come out with these one-liners. So she says she doesn't mind. I'm suggesting that society is getting messages all the time in culture because of this, from people in society, from people who matter, from people who are leaders, and as a result, people are taking on board messages, well, it doesn't matter here, it doesn't matter there. In England, a senior Anglican clergyman recently said he felt that sex outside of marriage is quite acceptable. Now, he's a senior clergyman, and I'm suggesting that what he says has a great import on the people, and they're affected by it. Now, what do you think? See, these are all parts of society. I know, and probably you know more than I know, because the minister usually finds out last, that we have young people in the church who do sleep around. God forbid. I hope it isn't in your family. I pray it will never happen in your family. But let's not kid ourselves. It does happen within the church. There are people of school age who are essentially in de facto relationships. And you scratch your head and say, well, what's gone wrong? What's happening? Well, I'm suggesting all these things in culture, whether it's the Mother's Union, whether it's a senior clergyman, whether it's the Duchess of York, they're all putting out various messages to this culture, which says you can do this, or it doesn't matter about that, and who cares about the other. And these things are taken on board by all of us to the extent that we represent what we do. So let's not assume that we have some immunity from what is happening out there, and let's not assume that our young people are not vulnerable, because they are vulnerable, as indeed we all are. Never mind the young, let's not pick on them. We all are vulnerable, but especially perhaps in that category and age group. Now, on the issue of parenting, does the Bible and the church speak clearly about some things, or are we also confused? Question. I would say that parenting is a very, very demanding role. I think it's very difficult to be a successful parent. I think it's incredibly difficult. I don't think it's the easiest thing in the world. The other thing I should say is that very few people are trained to do it. Very few are trained to do it. And again, I hearken back to the 100-year principle. If you saw it in your parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, you might be a whiz at it. Otherwise, you're struggling like everybody else. So fatherhood and motherhood still become some of the life's great challenges that we face. The Sunday Times had a poll recently. Let me give you some more facts and figures, because these are interesting. The Sunday Times poll said 40% of parents polled felt they were unprepared for parenting. 40% felt they were unprepared for parenting. They didn't really know what they were getting into. 30% of parents felt their children were out of control. These are fairly high figures. I don't know what you feel about your children or your family, but 30% of parents at large felt that their children were out of control. How many parents are cool, calm, collected? Some are. I would suggest in most homes you've got a battlefield of conflict and anxiety. It sort of waxes and wanes depending on who's up at the moment. But it comes and goes, or the state of the moon, or whatever it might be, but it comes and goes with a lot of places. There's anxiety, and it's a bit of a battlefield for some. But it may be that yours is cool, calm, and collected. You've got, they tell us, 18 years to shape a child, give or take a year, before they move on. One wit, and I like this quote, said, most of us would have more success maturing whiskey for 18 years than we would children. It would be far more mature if we sat in a barrel of whiskey. Well, you take the point that it, with whiskey, you just sit on it and do nothing. Maybe the temperature's got to be right. But with children, they come and go and they change day in, day out, year in, year out, relentlessly. Philip Larkin, the poet, he said this, speaking of parenting, he said, they raise you up, your mum and dad. They may not mean, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had and add some extra just for you. Now, again, I think there's some essential truth in that. you'll pick up all the faults of mum and dad, and they'll throw in a few more besides for good measure. 40% of parents say they're too soft on their children, feel they should be harder. 12% say they're too hard on their children, feel that they should ease up. 1 in 3 parents admits to having favourites in their children, which is a capital offence. But 1 in 3 admit that they have a favourite child, and that reaps endless problems, which you can read about. What is it that hassles parents most about their children? Let's talk about it this way around. I'll come to the kids later. What is it that parents dislike most in their children? And there are 6 things I've written down here that come up most often. First of all, parents hate bad tempers in their children, or wrong attitudes, we might say. Then they hate, secondly, children that answer back, sassy. Thirdly, they hate arguments among siblings. Parents hate it when the kids argue among themselves. And that's the subject of the next parenting study, I think. Depends on what Mr. Pate is doing. But we did talk about doing that. I believe that, isn't that next week? Next week is the parenting study, and we may well get to that issue about what happens when children argue among themselves in the family environment. Number 4, disobedience is what hassles parents most about their children. Number 5, asking for things that the parents can't afford. That's a burden. And number 6, emotional upsets, just emotional situations. So bad tempers, answering back, arguments among siblings, disobedience, asking for things we can't afford, and emotional upsets. They are the 6 most often cited things that parents dislike or that hassle them about their children. It's true to say that many, many parents today are cold and distant from their children. Now, it may always have been so. You may find in the 100-year rule it was worse. So I know if your parents weren't warm to you, it'll be very hard for you to be warm to yours. And so it goes. And to change that will take mighty effort. It can be done, but you'll have to be very conscious of it. Quality time is very, very rare. In fact, one researcher said this, and I thought this was interesting. One researcher said, there is no such thing as a meaningful relationship with a teenager. Sorry, kids. You can take that as a blanket statement from one person. You may have a very, very good relationship with your teens. I hope you do. But by and large, it's a statement that will come up frequently, that there is no such thing as a meaningful relationship with a teenager, because they're in such a transitional state and they may or may not respond in a certain way. 1 in 5 parents feel that their children lying is a very disturbing trend or position to be in. You do get the parents that say, oh, my child would never lie to me. And you wonder how blind the parent would be or how wonderful the angel is that they're rearing, as the case may be. But most parents are very disturbed by that. And on the other hand, most parents are very frank and candid with their children. Most parents try to be open and honest. And 85% of parents believe they can discuss right and wrong with their children. So there's a certain ability to be candid and straightforward and to bring things out in the open that way. So although there are conflicts here, although 85% feel they can be candid with their children and they can be frank with them, 85% of parents also find discussing sex, drugs and bereavement almost impossible. So they can be candid and frank in a subject they're content with or happy with, but if it comes to bereavement or drugs or sexual issues, then they find that very, very difficult to handle. 85% of parents said so. Parents shudder at the very thought of their children taking drugs, joyriding, or getting into vandalism. Excuse me. They're the real big fears. Taking drugs, joyriding, or vandalism. Well, again, if the family is a family unit working together, those things can certainly be minimized, if not eradicated. You know, there's a movement in society today to decriminalize marijuana, which you probably know is pretty widespread in its use. But it is still dangerous. And it is still far more dangerous than cigarette smoking. And one thing I would have thought would have put young people off from marijuana smoking was one thing it does is slow down your learning curve. You do not learn as much or as fast if you smoke marijuana. That's but one of its faults. Anyway, I'm not going to go on about that. I've studied it at some length and I'm a little bit aware of the situation there. But parents are most concerned about that type of involvement that their children can get into. And the decriminalising set has it that marijuana is no worse than cigarette smoking, therefore why not let it happen? That's a problem. All right, well, those are some of the situations. How do we deal with these issues? How do we deal with them? I would say it's going to be very, very personal and extremely individual as to what we may or may not do in given situations. Overly corrected children tend to become problem teenagers. Overly corrected tend to be problem teenagers, except in New Zealand. They did a parallel survey in New Zealand and found the opposite, which tells you a lot about the Kiwis. It also tells you a lot about us, whichever way you care to read it. Perhaps it tells you a lot about surveys. But the New Zealand survey said that overly corrected children respond very well. In this country, it found that they did not, that they became problem teenagers. I would say the truth is that if you're on the lax side, you're a bit easygoing, you're more likely to wind up with troubles. But you've got to find that balance, obviously, within your own family. Most parents do correct their children. There's no doubt about that, sometimes too often. The important thing is to make any correction fit the child in question, to fit the particular issue and the child in question. I'll just give you some typical corrections that are fulfilled by most parents. The most often used punishments in descending order, or increasing order, shall we say, from the least to the greatest. The least used punishment for a child is corporal punishment. Next, not speaking to a child. Send them to Coventry. The next one up the list is no pocket money. The next one up is smacking, which you might see as corporal punishment, but smacking is a smack. Corporal punishment is a little bit heavier. The next one up the list is you're not allowed to go out. You're confined to barracks or whatever it is. The next one up the list is you're given a work or a chore job to do. The next one up the list is there's no TV or no treats, no sweets. The next one up the list is you're sent to your room. And the top of the list is you're simply told off. So most often, kids are told off. Then they're sent to their room, or then there's no TV, or you're given a job, or you're not allowed to go out, or you can't see your friends, or you're smacked, or you get no pocket money, or the parent won't speak to you, or you really get a thumping. And it just comes down that order. That's the general trend of what most parents would do. Parents do smack less often today, but one in three will occasionally smack, and that also is usually a younger child. It might also reflect on the church of the years going by, and whether we reflect society there in many, many ways, that we would probably smack a lot less often in the church today than we used to. A lot less often. Of that there'll be no doubt. Not surprisingly, you'll find in most homes the mother plays the largest role in bringing up the children. By far and away the largest role, although the domination of certain things is split. Mother dominates in clothing, eating, and emotional support. But the father still dominates in the education of the children and in their leisure activities. So dad still controls leisure and education. Mother controls just about everything else. And you might think your family has got it all together in all of these areas, but this is the trends of society today. The decline of the family value is said by many, many people to be the greatest threat to society today. The breakup of the family, the breakdown of the family, is being looked at as the greatest threat to society. Now you can argue it never was strong, it never was wonderful, and so on and so forth. You can argue, again, back 100 years or more. But nonetheless, it's being cited as an issue. So what I'm saying and repeating is that modern parenthood is very difficult in the culture we live in. We now have a situation in a culture where the single parent family is very commonplace. It's not unusual to have single parent families, but the point is being made that the other missing parent is missed. The missing parent is missed. Some go so far as to say, this is some researchers, some papers being written, they go so far as to say a relationship with one parent is unhealthy. And they're looking again at the 100-year rule, saying it's unhealthy. Now, you've got to look at all things in balance when you say those things, but people do look at facts and figures, and that's what they come up with. So, despite the mother's union that knocked the nuclear family, despite the senior Anglican clergy who said you can have sex outside of marriage, it doesn't care. Well, he may not have said that, but that's what's reported to have been said. Despite the Duchess of York who says, well, I don't mind my husband goes off another woman in front of the kids. Despite what we have in society with lesbians and other things, nonetheless, research tells us that the different family reaps a fruit that you don't really want. Not only that, there is a godly model which suggests two parents. If you look at the Bible, you do see a godly model of two parents. Not only that, but you see the extended family, which you can still have in single-parent families, and hopefully you do, aunts, uncles, and so on and so forth. But what do you see from Scripture? What does Scripture tell you? Well, it tells you that God cares for children. It tells you that God responds to children's needs, whether it's us or our children in that collective sense. God cares for us. He responds to our needs. He forgives us. He disciplines his children. It says that. He does comfort his children, and he does listen to his children. So you've got lots of umbrella statements from Scripture as to what God feels about people and families. Now, we all know that some families break down and some of us are left. Well, you might be left an orphan. You know, these aren't things you can control. You're stuck with some things. And then you do your very best in that configuration to make it work out. And by and large, people do a very good job. No one's knocking that. And people are trying to be very encouraging. But when you look at the theory of these things, if you break a law, even if you're innocent, you do reap the penalty for it. That's the point, I think, that comes through. When you look at what research tells you and what the godly model is telling you as well. You break a law, you suffer. It may not be that you deserve it. It might be that you're getting the tough end of the stick, but you cop it as it goes. Look, in God's approach, let me read just two or three scriptures to you from John and Peter, beginning in 1 John 5, and just get a little bit of a sense of what God is able to project in the scriptures about family and the sensitivities to parent or child approaching God. Beginning in 1 John 5 and verse 14. I'm just picking out two or three scriptures here. 1 John 5:14. It says, this is the confidence we have in approaching God. And as children, we are able to do that. That if we ask anything according to his will, he hears us. So, I'm using these scriptures because I want us to realize that there is a sense you're not abandoned, you're not cut off, you're not isolated from God, but you can work through things and you can understand what the scripture says. So he does hear us and we can approach him. And if we know that he hears us, whatever we ask, we know that we have what we asked of him. You know you've been heard. All right, so that's important. In whatever status you're in life, whether you feel hard done by, whether you feel oppressed, whatever it may be, that there is that relationship with God. Now, if you go back to Peter, and I'll just go back in descending order, 1 Peter 5, 1 Peter 5 and verse 7, it says this, it says, cast all your anxiety on him because he cares for you, so you know that God is supportive. This is just to reinforce the principle of what the godly model is about. Cast your cares on him because he is there for you in that way. And also back into 1 Peter 2 and verse 10. 1 Peter 2 and verse 10. It says, once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. All right, so somewhere back in the 100-year spectrum, you may or may not have been in the church, in the family, or with the understanding of God, but now you are. And you can begin to change and reshape and remodel what you hope to achieve with your offspring. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. So even if your past is flawed, there is a relationship with God. That, I think, is the essence of those scriptures. Wouldn't matter what your past was, wouldn't matter what your difficulty was, whether it's today or 100 years ago, there has to be a turnaround point at some stage. There has to be an access point to God where you don't feel cut off and isolated and totally helpless. These scriptures, I think, tell us that. That there is an opening and an opportunity to begin to move things around. Now, the world will talk about this in terms of self-esteem. If you want self-esteem in your children, you can boil it down to some very simple skills. And they are these. You treat people with respect, whether it's your peers or your children, and in particular your children. You treat them with respect. You appreciate them. And you are straight and you're honest with them. Straight, honest, appreciation, and you have what you can spend hours and hours and hours researching for and looking for in people. Now, one man just isolates all of this and he calls it the PIN system, the PIN number. You're all familiar with your bank PIN numbers and things like that. Well, PIN, P-I-N, to this researcher is this: positive, interesting, negative. And so when dealing with people, or children in particular, he'll say it this way. He'll say PIN, positive, say something positive. I, for interesting, point out something interesting in what's happening. Maybe an original idea or something like that, or an original concept that the child or the person may have. And three, the negative, the N, you comment on that if necessary. So the PIN system of building this self-esteem, of respect and appreciation and so on, is to do with this aspect of being positive, interesting, and then negative if you need to be. Say something positive, point out the interesting things, and comment on the negative if you need to. I have found that if a child is always praised, and they praise them, praise them, praise them, praise them, and praise them, and you know there's a certain movement to do that, they found that sometimes with some children, when they get to be adults, they expect to be praised for the rest of their life. And then when they're adults and they're not told how wonderful they are for the rest of their lives, they burn out, go bananas. No one loves me anymore, because no one's telling them how wonderful they are every 5 minutes. So you have to be careful with the relationship issues, that you don't take one thing and run it off in a direction that becomes an issue and a problem to you later on. Most children will see things in very, very black and white terms. Very black and white. If something goes wrong, they will assume it's their fault or they're bad. That will be assumed. Now, you may not imply that or mean that, but it will be assumed unless you've got a rapport, you've got this respect, appreciation and so on that you're working through, otherwise it might be taken on board. It's not easy. It's not easy. And that's why I say it's very individual and you have to work your way through that. I would say perhaps try to be positive is about the best way to analyze the whole thing. Just try and be positive about it. Now, if the parents could pin back their ears, here's a list of things that children most would like to see in their parents. And it's quite a long list. It goes like this. Let me know you love me and value me. Don't nag me, otherwise I'll switch off and not listen. When I do something wrong, don't make me feel really, really bad, because everyone makes mistakes. I hate it when you tell me how good, talented or responsible other children are. If you make a promise to me, don't break it. Don't tell me off in front of others. It makes me feel really stupid. I know I say I hate you sometimes, but I don't really mean it. Don't give me everything I want. I'm just pushing to see how far I can go. Don't keep changing the rules, otherwise I get confused about what I can and can't do. Don't take it out on me when somebody else upsets you. Some of my aches and pains are just for attention. Do show me hugs and cuddles sometimes, as I need to feel the warmth of your love. If I'm really worried or upset about something, don't tell me it's stupid, because it isn't to me. If you're worried or upset about something, don't pretend nothing is wrong, because that makes me anxious. And finally, don't stay angry with me for too long, because I need your acceptance and love. Now, they're very adult comments, but they're what teenagers and children say about their parents consistently. They come up in lists over and over again, and they're big issues. Now, to me, healthy parenting includes this: clear beliefs, held firmly, but not rigidly. So you have a clear idea where you're going, you firmly believe them, but you're not rigid. You can change if there's a need to. Also, it involves consistent behavior. The parent has to have consistent behavior patterns. Also, there is a balance between reason and emotion. If you're all emotion, you'll lose them. If it's all logic and black and white and there's no emotion, you'll lose them. There's got to be a balance between emotion and reason. There's a movement between the two, a sense of feeling what is required. There has to be an interaction with other people. It cannot be all one-sided or all the way you see it. It has to be an interaction. You do have to be non-judgmental toward others who believe and behave differently. And we've touched on that in terms of perhaps the subject of forgiveness and other areas. So non-judgmental, it doesn't mean you agree with what they do, but you don't judge them for it. Doesn't mean you go along with it. Don't misunderstand what's being said. You do have to be responsible for your own actions. This is parenting. You do have to have the ability to forgive. That's most important. You do have to have the ability to see your own faults objectively. And very few do. See your own faults objectively. Or as somebody else put it, if we saw ourselves the way God sees us, we might get a shock. And you do have to have the ability to express and serve compassion. To express compassion. Now look, you could add to that list. It's a never-ending list. It just goes on and on. Francis Bacon, many, many years ago, said this. He said, "The joys of parents are secret, and so are their griefs and fears." The joys of parents are secret, and so are their griefs and fears. In other words, it can be very demanding, and it can also be very lonely. It can be quite stressful. You do have to keep moving your myths to one side. If there are things you've got in your 100-year history which are wrong, you've got to keep shoving them out. If you have ideas that don't work, remove them. If you have things that really are not working, or that are antagonizing or disturbing people, then those things have to be moved also. You do have to keep building up what you would require and what you would see as godly parenting traits. And you evaluate them from the godly model, which I commented on, as to what God would expect. And it is a model of care and concern, and those things are most important. So I'm not going to give you any more lists and things. I think I've probably said enough. But I wanted to mention a little bit about child rearing and about parenting in this way, in this context. That it is a difficult area. It's a demanding area. It's a moving area. It's an area where society is changing quite rapidly, where things are becoming more and more acceptable out there that you may or may not agree with. You can find yourself drifting with some of them, or you can find yourself opposing it. When you could meet, for instance, two lesbians with a couple of children, and you could say the children are very well behaved, therefore it works. Or you could say, in 100 years' time, I wonder what will happen with the end result of that relationship, because it is not based on the godly model. So it's difficult. It becomes personal. You can offend people very quickly, and you can cause great distress with some people and some families and some environments. But it is an area to be most concerned about within your own relationships. You do have to be concerned for your own marriage, and you do have to be concerned for your own children. And having said that, I'd like to close by a few comments and say that really all you can do is strive to be the very best parent you can. Doesn't mean you'll be perfect. It doesn't mean you won't make mistakes. But you do have to be able to hold your head up at the end of it and say, well, I did my very best. And by and large, I think we do have success rate, which is very, very high. We aim then to produce a healthy child who in turn will marry and produce hopefully an even healthier family and a better environment again than we ever provided ourselves. We hope that things go on in that way. I do think that throughout parenting and throughout child rearing, one of the greatest things you can have is a very large dose of common sense. You do need a very, very level head and a very placid nature to be able to cope. Lots of common sense. Read about that, think about that, and consider it, because it will take you through many of the hurdles which in time then level out to be non-issues. And you can make mountains out of molehills, so pick your battles with great care. Some parents will pick a battle with a child on every single issue, and you wind up with a battlefield. My advice is choose your battles with care, and if you want to fight an issue, fulfill it. But it doesn't mean you have to fight every battle on every issue, on every point, every time. So you do have to find your level of common sense in the relationships that you will have within your family and indeed your extended family. With the godly model, your family should be surrounded by concern and love. And you can boil it down to very simple sentences like that. Your family, the model that God sets, is a relationship between you and your children, the children and you, the extended family, the people that you know, whether it's in the church, in your own family, whatever it may be. It's based on concern and love. And you work your way through the issues from there, because that is the essence of God's Spirit in us. And that's our potential, and that's our ability. Now, I hope that all of us, as the years go by, do increase and improve and prosper in that sense of relationships within the family. I hope we all wind up in this theoretical sense of having a good rapport with our children and our grandchildren. You know, sadly, many of us don't. There are some families where the grandchildren are never seen because the alienation is so deep. It's removed. They've gone. They may never be seen again. There are some families where parent and child are never reconciled, even to the point of death. They are never reconciled because the hurt was so deep and so profound. So common sense is a byword. And I don't use the word lightly. I use it very, very keenly and strongly, because that is the leveling ground for all of these issues and points. And if we're all mindful of that, and you get these principles in mind as to where we're going, it makes it a lot easier. So parenting can be lonely, it can be difficult, but it can be done. It can also be very encouraging and very rewarding. So let's hope we all wind up with some big, big smiles on our faces as the years go by. Happy parenting.